Good evening. Welcome to the Solaria Report. Today is Thursday, September 15th, 2011. I'm Catherine Austin Fitz, and I'm delighted you could join me this evening. Tonight, Startup Financing for the Rest of Us, a wonderful conversation with Peter Ireland. It's a great one to have the private blog up for. We've had, we launched last week, and we were able to put up lots of links and our U.S. dollar charts for this evening. And, of course, after tonight, we'll have the MP3 posted there and with an outline and chapter so you can break it down and listen to the parts you want. And I encourage you to use it. We've gotten a few comments so far and some good ones on this blog post. To read the comments or to post, you have to click on that exact blog link and go in. But this gives us a chance to organize very rich resources around each Solaria report, so we're pretty excited about it. If you have any trouble using your new access or navigating around your way around, please let Darlene Heckman know, who runs customer service at 888-755-3548, and let Darlene know anything we can do to make the Solaria Report experience more excellent for you. Our theme tonight is slow burn. The U.S. dollar index since the beginning of September has been rising steadily, pushing through the $76 ceiling it's at. Several times this year, climbing above 75, now backing down between 76 and 77. Don't be surprised to see it get as high as 80 during this rally. We continue to watch fears about whether the Germans and French are going to hold the dollar together in the face of a expected Greek default and more sovereign debt write-downs around Europe. Can it bring the euro and the dollar back to parity? That's a good question. The dollar continues to a taxing authority, a powerful central bank, and a military. And it controls, that military controls access, and the whole operation controls access to what is still the richest single unified market in the world. And that gives the dollar a strength that the euro doesn't have. It's contiguous to a large committee whose members have taxing power and have militaries, but it's a very, very different political mechanism behind that currency, and it makes it much harder to hold it together under pressure. Europe's economic condition, in my opinion, is much more fundamentally sound than the United States, both the health of the people and the infrastructure. At the same time, politics could really go south. The rumors today of bank runs in Spain and other parts of the of Europe are pretty hot and heavy, and it's very hard to sort out the real, the wheat from the chaff, but they're clearly, it's a lot of fear running around in the markets right now. Gold and silver traded down. Gold is trading at 1776, silver at 3950. That's a drop from the recent highs, particularly for gold, and the 2011 high for silver, which was earlier this year, but it's up almost 30% for the year compared to a stock market that's down for the year. And it's acting like it could go much further. So, you know, we see these periods where the slow burn reinserts itself, where revenues are deflating and expenses continue to inflate, and it's an ugly kind of squeeze. And it's a good time for the Thrive documentary to launch its trailer this week. It's up on the blog, and it's also up at their website under thrivemovement.com. And whenever you feel the slow burn this way, it's kind of the financial equivalent of, I can't believe I ate the whole thing, because there's more and more debasement, and debt reengineering is just terribly unpleasant. And Thrive is a two-hour documentary. It's quite extraordinary. I've seen it. I've seen the current cut. And the trailer is very short, and it's a delightful presentation. And it really goes to the heart of real solutions to kind of jump the curve on the whole unending debasement scenario. So I think it's the perfect time to enjoy something like that. The tickets went on for the premiere, which is in San Francisco in November, went on sale last Saturday. I was hoping to buy 20. They sold out 2 hours despite a maximum purchase per person. So instead of getting my 20, I got locked out at 4 and 2 for two complimentaries I get because I was one of the people interviewed. Simultaneous to the premiere, Thrive will be available in 9 languages globally through the Internet, so that's in November. House party kits are going to be available in October. Again, you can see the trailer at the Solaria blog or at thrivemovement.com, and I really encourage you to check it out because I think it's the documentary, which is really an invitation to the website, is going to be part of inspiring a very new and positive conversation about real solutions, so I'm encouraged. Money and markets. The global unemployment continued to increase, and with it, it continued to increase political tensions. I think that's part of what's making it difficult for the Germans and the French to come up with political solutions for what's going on in Europe. Unemployment claims in the U.S. rose higher than expected. New census data showing U.S. poverty rising, you know, at a 15% rate. That doesn't include a lot of the government transfer payments, though, so it's not as ugly quite as it looks, but it's still a very ugly picture. More details came out on the president's proposal, particularly how he plans to pay them for the new Job Act, which he presented in the joint session of Congress last week. He's sneaking towards a flat tax. Most of the funding is coming from basically a $70 billion haircut against essentially upper-middle-class people who would be limited in their deductions. That's going to be a big hit on the mortgage deduction in that group of taxpayers and the benefits coming from municipal bonds. So we could really see it having a dampening effect on that market. The municipal bond market was, all the lobbyists were squeaking like crazy. Another portion is the cutting of the payroll taxes. It's almost a question of, is this a good idea? In the latest annual report, Social Security Board of Trustees reported that the federal government's total revenue from Social Security taxes in 2010 was $544.8 billion, not enough to cover, on a pay-as-you-go basis, Social Security's total benefit payments of $577.4 billion. Now, you know, it takes many decades for the fund to run dry. Problem, of course, is it's not producing a cash surplus to continue to finance the deficit. 401k, we've had more sort of trial balloons floated by this time, new ones coming from Brookings, which has been the source of more than a few of these, to re-engineer how 401ks are done, this time proposing that we move away from tax deduction to a tax credit. I have been thinking that these kinds of re-engineerings might get delayed, but now we see and blog post on this if you want to go into it more. I'll probably be talking about it when we go into the October wrap-up. On Thursday, the Senate Finance Committee is going to have testimony, quote, tax reform options promoting retirement security. And Reuters is now floating something saying that U.S. retirement programs could look different if the grand, quote, deficit cutting bargain is struck in upcoming negotiations. So it looks like the 401k and IRA fluidity is may come back onto the agenda, and of course that's something I'm going to watch very carefully. It's too bad Obama did not stop or cancel civil money penalty seizure and enforcement kickbacks. A report from one of the real incredible leaders of the fresh food movement for the last several decades in the United States. He writes a very chilling note. A young couple, this is from Wisconsin, a young couple appeared on our farm this afternoon in a smart open Jeep asking to purchase some organic raw milk. They were just leaving when I arrived, so I did not meet them. But when I asked the farmer's wife, did she sell them any, she said, are you kidding? Quote, they, quote, are now offering people $2,000 to go around to find anyone selling raw milk. They have targeted Wisconsin to make an example of someone. He's describing a $2,000 enforcement payment to someone who catches someone improperly selling raw milk. He continues, I personally find anyone setting up a system for members of the public to spy on each other in this way very disturbing. This is, to me, the worst form in which to demoralize a nation. This is how the Nazis worked, and I remember the fear I experienced in a village of the Black Forest before the war, World War II, when I was only 7 years old and didn't understand what was going on. The atmosphere was totally loaded with it, and getting back to Britain, I still had nightmares. Surely some of Wisconsin's farm children under 12 or 14 will pick something up when their parents are being spied on. The covert QE3 continues. All across the country, we're seeing fires, flooding, drought. All of these things, of course, are very damaging to the real economy. But the patterns continue to cause me to believe that the government agencies are taking back a significant amount of mortgage paper from the large financial institutions under the guise of emergencies. The recent fires in Texas were particularly disturbing. If you look at the patterns, they're really very reminiscent of other efforts of using fire to clean up mortgage fraud. The beauty of cycling all these mortgages back to the government is you can destroy the files, particularly if the government forecloses and the mortgage goes away. CNN reports higher foreclosures in August. I would love to see the detailed data, as my concern is it reflects a variety of operations at Freddie, Fannie, FHA, Farmers Home, VA, that are cleaning up both losses and liabilities at taxpayers' expense. Another reason to avoid smart meters, as those of you who listen to this O'Leary report know, I'm like the dog circling the bush saying, no, I know there's a duck there, I know there's a duck there, and I have a very, I'm very uncomfortable with smart meters and where they could go and how they could be used. But we see the announcement from Greece. The Greeks are instituting a property tax nationwide, and sure enough, how is the tax going to be collected? Through the utility bills. You don't pay your increased taxes, and your energy gets cut off. I would note the biggest provider of the software to date for the smart meters is IBM. They're the lead contractor on the census. Very interesting dovetail if you're creating software for all, you know, all the households in the nation that the taxpayers just paid you on the census to build another database of all the households in the country. But reporting Kiplinger, quote, a huge multi-disk storage and files is underway at IBM. The monster system would eventually lead to lower storage costs for all users, but initial applications will be for complex simulations of weather and seismic data, as well as for other scientific uses. IBM won't name the client that wants the system. The new machine will store 10 times as much data as today's biggest drives, 120 million gigabytes. It will consist of 200,000 conventional drives that are linked. Because the system will generate a lot of heat, it will be cooled with water, not air. I continue to think a lot about what I call the next big primary trend. I've been talking about a few Solari reports. We continue to watch what is happening in the effort to repatriate corporate funds without taxes, extinguish mortgage files, and what that means to real estate and real estate gentrification in this country. We've talked for many years now. The current big primary trend is a fundamental shift in the relationship between paper and tangible assets. But what I think may be emerging as the next big primary trend is a fundamental shift in the relationship between assets that store value, like precious metals, and assets that generate income, like real estate and operating enterprises. So I'm going to keep watching that, and that's going to be a big topic of conversation in our third quarter wrap-up, which will be in the first week of October. Our hero this week is Michael Hart, just recently died. Michael was the head and founder of Project Gutenberg. It was the first producer of e-books, free e-books, tremendous number of e-books now up on the web through Project Gutenberg. Check out Project Gutenberg. It's linked in the blog, and I put the link to Michael's obituary up on the blog. His life is a fascinating story and a reminder that there are many, many wonderful people who are making a huge difference to each of our lives and sort of the commons, that part of the world that we all share. And I just think he is somebody really worth knowing about and honoring. A couple of runner-ups this week, because there were a lot of interesting people doing things this week. Runner-up, Forbes magazine reports that Tyler Perry is the highest paid man in entertainment. Tyler Perry is the creator and both producer, director, and actor who plays Medea. And I'm a huge Tyler Perry fan. I think his movies and plays are warm and funny and celebrate the human experience. And I find it amazing that Tyler Perry, who is really, family entertainment, beat out a lot of the other names in Hollywood. It's including, I would point out, Howard Stern, who is number 9. So I think it's a sign of the times that the nice guy should be number 1 in the entertainment world. And finally, honorable mention to Matt Taibbi, who had a new piece blog post on the UBS announcement of a $2 billion loss as a result of quote-unquote a rogue trader. In the financial world, a rogue trader is the financial equivalent of the, quote, loan assassin. Anyway, but it's a remarkable blog post. It's up on the Solari blog, and I encourage you to take a look at it. Okay, ask Catherine. Lots of questions and comments tonight. We talked in Precious Metals last week. Frank had a wonderful story about his Texas customer who couldn't cash her check. A comment from a subscriber in Korea. I thought you might be interested to know here in Seoul, people routinely carry around checks for $10,000. Recently, I went to my local bank to get $10,000 in cash, and they had it with no problems or major questions asked. Most bank customers have ATM with $10,000 in a single day. Yes, that's $10,000. Another example of non-leverage in the South Korean economy is that to buy a home, you have to have 50 to 60% down. The most leverage you could put down is 40% down if your credit is incredible and you're dealing with the right bank. That certainly reflects, the cash story certainly reflect my experiences in Europe. Now, obviously, Europe's maybe in different times right now, but certainly last year, you know, if you go up to an ATM in Zurich, you can get plenty of cash. It's a reminder that a lot of what's happening today in the U.S. banking system, in my opinion, is a policy. It does not reflect market conditions. But it does remind all of us it's important to have lots of resources outside of the banking system and to bank at banks where you're known, with people you trust. But there are plenty of ways to have resources outside the banking system, from precious metals to cash at home to stockpiling non-perishable inventories to setting up your home base and operation so you can be as comfortably self-sufficient as possible, and so it reduces the need for cash. Another question, I'm about to purchase land in New Hampshire as part of an intentional community based on mindfulness practice, and I wonder about the area's financial ecosystem and how to begin going about mapping it. Would you please advise? If you go to the blog and do a search for using the word financial ecosystem, you'll pull up a bunch of links, one of them called Mapping Our Local Financial Ecosystems. I put up in the links to this Solari report, and it'll give you an idea of the breakdown of the different areas of data that you want to collect and know about. You certainly want to get the consolidated annual financial accounts for that local area, for your county, for your state as well. Anyway, but try those links. There's a lot there. I also posted up in the link for the resources for the Solari report a link to positioning your assets for growth in uncertain times and the impact on your community. And it's really about how much money is debased in a community, and that goes to the importance of what you're going to keep your financial assets and liquidity in. Are you going to keep it in dollars or something else? Eric Sprott's recent comments on gold and silver. Eric Sprott, among others, recently predicted gold to go to $12,000 per ounce and silver to overshoot the 1 to 16 ratio to 110, finally resting at 1,200. What are your thoughts on his prediction? You have a fair amount of folks right now who are constantly trying to give you a number of what would happen if all the paper had been issued was reconciled to the amount of gold and silver outstanding, and they come up with estimates like this. I think the chances of that are remote unless it's considered politically desirable. A price run up that high will bring war long before prices get that high. We're looking at a politically managed situation, and the way that these kinds of the issues of what assets get respected vis-a-vis tangibles and what don't is determined by war and force, not by market prices. So I think that is very unlikely unless the powers that be want to do a radical debasement, which I don't see as a likely scenario, but, you know, of course, anything could happen. Hi, Catherine. I don't know if you've seen this video from Rushkoff, but it's a lot like what you're trying to accomplish with Solari Circles, right? I was watching it because of his great article he wrote for CNN today. I've put that video up on the blog. It's under geopolitics. It's really wonderful. You know, I think he's a very intelligent, very capable guy. And I loved his article for CNN, which I put up on the blog last week. So if you just do a search for Rushkoff, you should be able to pick up the article, and you can find that video under geopolitics. It's short, and it's quite nice. Hi, Catherine. I was reading this article in Zurich today, and it got me wondering if the U.S. did return to the gold standard, how would that affect gold prices and the world economy generally? It's an article from Zero Hedge talking about Huntsman's. It's a WikiLeaks of a Huntsman, I think it was a Telegraph, but it basically is talking about China's gold ambition. So it gets back to the question of, you know, could we go back to a gold standard, which I think is very unlikely. If we do go back to, since where the world wants to go, or at least the leadership wants to go, is digital currency, and they don't really care if it's, you know, if it's gold or wampum beads, they just want control. But if they do use gold, I can assure you we're going to end up with a fiat gold standard, given the fact that there's not very much gold, and it's a very big planet. I do think that gold is really, you know, that we are on a gold standard and a metal. If you look at the IMF and the relationship between the central banks, we're already there. If we're not already there, we're certainly heading there. But I think the likelihood of a hard gold standard is pretty remote. But again, you know, anything can happen. I often tell the story of emailing with a group of people from the financial blogosphere who were telling me constantly that the dollar was going to crash, the dollar's going to crash, and finally said what do you think? And I said, who here has watched the documentary Phoenix Lights, which is a wonderful documentary about a huge UFO that floated down the side of Arizona in 1996. So slowly, one by one, they came back and confessed that they'd all watched the Phoenix Lights documentary. And I said, okay, well, I think if we could figure out who owns that UFO, I think the dollar's going to do whatever he wants it to do. And that's how it's going to go down. The reality is, if you look at the prices that we're watching in the global economy when it comes to currency or big movements, is that the people who control the physical space, whether it's the satellite lanes or the sea lanes, the people who can control with or kill with impunity are the ones who are determining how things go. And, these things are not determined by economics. They're determined by force. And so when you look at the economy, we just have to remember, whether we're talking about a gold standard or radical debasement, that what's going to happen is going to be determined by politics, not so much by markets. Okay, that's it for Ask Catherine. Keep the questions coming. Next week we have Adam Trombley on Zero Point Energy, so I know you have a lot of questions. And I would really encourage you to get those, because I'll get those to Adam. He's very eager to see what they are. So tonight it's my real pleasure to introduce to you Peter Ireland. Peter is the author. He's a serial entrepreneur. He's got a fabulous website that I've used for many years, and I know lots of entrepreneurs have used. I've talked to our wonderful Ben Lazzardi, runs the communication firm that handles all of our business, and he said, you know, I've bought a whole bunch of Peter Ireland's books over the years. I give them to everybody. And when you talk to people who are good entrepreneurs and support other entrepreneurs, you'll always find out that one way or another they're plugged into Peter Ireland's work or his writings or his website. And so this is a book. I've bought many copies and given many copies away. In fact, I once taught a class during the financial permaculture course and required that everybody go out and get Peter Ireland's book. And Peter has very kindly put up a special link for Solari people to go in and get some of his materials, and I've posted it on the blog. It's sort of a special deal for Solari, and I encourage you to take a look at it. So Peter comes to us from Washington, and we're very pleased to have him. Peter, are you with us?
Hi, Catherine.
Hi.
Hi. Well, yes, I'm with you. I'm glad I didn't get the buttons mixed up, and that was a fascinating talk, actually. I've been invited to these types of things before, and usually I skip a preamble, but that was just a fabulous talk. I'm interested in a lot of these things myself these days, and you know, I really just want to...
Well, as you know, all of our guests get complimentary subscriptions, so you have access to the full archive, so just dive in.
I'm going to be going through that.
The funny thing, though, Peter, is every week I end up at the growing unemployment, mm-hmm. and one of the things I know is that the only way to address that situation is with the kind of startup and entrepreneurship that you've been a proponent of your whole life.
Yes.
So one of the reasons I wanted to do this Solari report is, you know, how do we get, you know, thousands, if not millions of people learning how to be successful entrepreneurs? Because that's part, there's so many great businesses. I was once in a restaurant in Cambridge and I said to somebody, this is such a wonderful restaurant. How did it get started? And he said, well, we didn't want to start a restaurant, but we had about 25 people and we needed to create jobs for them. So we asked them what they all did and we realized, okay, well, if we started a restaurant, we could get them all working. So, you know, we're kind of in that situation. But let me just dive in because I love the Smart Startup Guide. I think it's the best book ever that I've ever found in a lifetime of looking about how to, you know, what's the right model to start up a business and how you do it with as little capital as possible. So if we could just dive in and you could explain how you came to write the book, and then what the difference is between your SMART model and sort of the venture model that many of us have been taught to have in our head. I would just love it.
Okay. Sure. Let me just do this in a few quick minutes here. It probably goes back to when I was about 10 years old. I developed a fascination with the whole idea of being self-employed, having my own little company to operate and not having to go into the corporate world, which never really appealed to me. So I just started taking an interest in all matters that had to do with starting up your own business and so on. Then we'll fast forward a few decades. It's the 1980s. And I started reading Inc. magazine, and Inc. magazine usually had at least one annual article on bootstrapping businesses and how members of their Inc. 500 list were started, you know, with absolutely minimal cash. And the articles never really went into all that much detail. You know, you'd have a two-page, three-page article that would cover a number of companies without really going into any detail. So I think it was around 1987 or so, I actually started calling up some of these companies that were in some of the articles. And, you know, occasionally I was given this half an hour with the CEO, and I was able to really dig into the details of how they got this company off the ground with, you know, zero outside capital and minimal internal capital. And I just started collecting these different methods for getting companies off the ground when financial resources are very scarce or non-existent. And, you know, I started realizing that there is a way to do it with a lot of different businesses. Obviously, you know, as we talked about the other day, the sitting duck model, you shouldn't really put a lot of time and energy into that one. That's a startup situation where you just require a huge amount of startup capital from the get-go, and I tell people to try to avoid those situations as much as possible and go for situations where you can start generating cash quickly. But to get back to the story and to wrap it up about how I got started, yes, I just started collecting these stories, and I mean, there's all sorts of creative financing solutions to startup problems, and one of the keys to understand that sort of opens up a new lens on the whole situation is to understand that, you know, you shouldn't be looking at how to finance a startup, but rather how to finance the individual assets that business will need to operate. And then that opens up a lot of options for each type of asset. And if you understand how all those individual assets can be financed, you can start coming up with ways to actually get the whole business up and running without, you know, waiting for individual investors to come along. So you know, it's just sort of an interest that I developed in childhood. I didn't come from a wealthy family; I just came from a middle class family, and I just sort of realized, well, if I'm going to do anything later on with the business, I'm gonna have to be creative. I'm gonna have to have creativity to compensate for a lack of family money that I could tap into. So that sort of gives you an idea how this all came about.
One of the things I've found is the more money you have when you start a business, the more mistakes you make, the more money you waste. And I think one of the things I love about your presentation, the Smart Startup Guide, is what I've found is you really do need a proof of product. And you're almost better starting an operation that prototypes something, because your customers will teach you an awful lot about whether the product and service you had in mind makes sense. And you'll see a lot of great businesses emerge just from people responding to requests. So if you look at my business now, all the different parts of Solaria came from people asking our help. You know, would you do this? Would you do that? Would you do this? And it emerged. You know, the project emerged out of the requests. And when you do it that way, it's a much more intelligent relationship between you and the market than when you just have an idea and you make it and sell it. You know, a lot of capital can get burned before you really sit down with a customer and see if this thing's going to go.
Oh, exactly. You know, there's a joke about Bill Gates that he never really had a good quality product to sell to the marketplace until version 3.0 came out. And I've always sort of used that philosophy. It's get the most basic stripped down product into the marketplace as quickly as you can, start generating some cash flow, and gather feedback, as you just said, from the customers. Find out what kinds of, you know, bells and whistles they want to see added onto it that they're willing to pay for, and just grow it that way.
Right. Another thing you focus on is what I call elasticity of demand. You want to make something that where there's an inelastic demand. In other words, you want to provide a product or service that is very important to people. It's essential to them. It's not superfluous. Maybe you could go into that as well.
Well, sure. That's actually a really important point that people need to understand. You know, you have a lot of these social networking websites out there these days, and you know, some of them have huge valuations despite the fact that they're not making much money. And I always have to wonder, well, you know, what really gives them that value? Because the next social networking site that comes along is just a mouse click away. So when the next one comes along that's a little bit hotter, how can they maintain their customer base, you know, their user base? And they really can't. I mean, you know, about 4 or 5 years ago, the hot social networking site was Friendster. Does anybody remember Friendster anymore? They don't.
No.
Then after that,
I
it
don't
was
think I ever knew
by,
it.
Oh, it was a lot like Facebook, but it's still around, but nobody ever talks about it. Nobody uses it. And then that one was followed by MySpace, and I think it was Rupert Murdoch that paid about, you know, $600 million for MySpace about 4 or 5 years ago. That was going to be his foray into online businesses, and I don't know if you're aware of this, but MySpace just got sold for about $35 million a couple of months ago. The actor Justin Timberlake was one of the members of the group that bought it for $35. So, you know, Rupert buys it for $600 million, roughly speaking. 5 years later, 4 years later, he sells it for $35 million. And I've never really been impressed by Facebook. Maybe it's a generational thing. I don't even have an account there. But, you know, I just don't see the point in it. And I certainly don't understand the valuation that they give it. But, you know, so my recommendation is, you know, hope for the best in terms of the economy, but prepare for the worst. I guess, you know, you and I sort of think the same way that way. So if you're going to start up a business, you know, you want something that's going to be selling a service or a product that people need, no matter how badly things get. You know, the off the top of the head examples would be, say, food, energy, such as, you know, gas, and other necessities. I mean, there are a lot of things that people absolutely need. And, you know, that's what I recommend to people. I mean, just setting up a website. I have a company that has a lot of websites, And I'm fully aware of the fact that the competitors that we have to, confront in the marketplace, they're all just a mouse click away for our customers. You know, they can just go, hey, the other site's selling the same widget, for a buck less. You know, they're selling it for $99. Peter's selling it for $100. I'm going to save a buck and go with the other guys. So, you want something that the people really need. I mean, if things really got turned bad and now, I'm not too optimistic about the next few years in terms of the economy and everything. You definitely want to be in a position where you're providing.
You want to be something that's useful. You just want to be doing something that's useful. You in the Smart Startup Guide, you give tremendous number of different sort of case studies and examples of people bootstrapping. And I won't ask you to go through all of them here, but maybe if you could give one or two examples of your sort of favorite stories.
There's a lot of them in there. The key is to find something, a situation where you can start selling something very, very quickly. I'll give you the example of a friend of mine who runs a contracting business that does renovations in the Seattle area, Mercer Island specifically, where all the Microsoft employees tend to live, and he does renovations like you want to improve your kitchen or add a room to a house or whatever. You do business with him, and he started off about 10 years ago, and he was flat broke. He just had an old SUV that he was driving around in. He didn't have tools, but he wanted to work as a carpenter. So he managed to find some work as a subcontractor where he was just banging nails, basically. You know, he'd bring his own tool belt, had two or three different hammers in there. And then, with the first paycheck, he started buying additional tools that would allow him to do more work, more complex work that he could charge up more for. So, one of the first investments was a jigsaw. And with the next paycheck, it was a circular saw. Then after that, probably a few paychecks to save up for the table saw, but he got that one. And then pretty soon he was on his own. He didn't have to work as a subcontractor under somebody else. He could go out there and solicit work himself. And that's a very simple example of a service business, but you use that same model to start up most businesses. As I mentioned a few minutes ago, you look at a potential product or service offering, and then you strip it down to the bare essentials, like what at a minimum do people need and are willing to pay for, and then you generate some sales. And then as you start to develop some cash flow, you start to say, well, okay, how can I make this more profitable for myself? What if I add this particular bell or this particular whistle to the basic offering? How much more would I be able to charge for it? So you do that, and then the cash flow improves a little bit more. Then you ask that same question again. Well, what else would my customers like to? Would need to have, not like to have, but what would need to have, and then you offer that, and then you start charging them for that, and that's the way to do it. Situations where
it really is a continuous learning process.
I there's a wonderful quote in the Smart Startup Guide that I attribute to this faculty member. I don't know if at Harvard or Columbia, because he's taught at both, but Dr. Amar Bide, he's written a lot on entrepreneurship, and he calls it the try it, fix it approach. Try it, fix it. That's all. That's what entrepreneurship is. I absolutely love that way of summing it up. Just try it and then fix it, because sometimes you'll find it from your customers that that's not really what they want, so you have to make some adjustments to it. So, try it, fix it, try it, fix it, and just keep expanding that way.
Another reason I like the Smart Startup Guide is I've always felt guilty about not doing better business plans, and yet, although I think it's very worthwhile to put a business plan or subject to sort of the mathematics of time and money, my feeling about most business plans is if we use this time to try and make, you know, a client or a customer happy and see what happens, we'd be much, much better off. And, you know, if we just get in there and sort of bootstrap it the way you're describing instead of writing a big business plan. And I think a lot of what you said about business plans relieved me of some of my guilt about not being better with business plans.
Well, you know, I just want to make a distinction between two types of business plans. The business plan that most people think of when anybody mentions those two words, you know, business plan, what they think of is the fancy selling document that people have crafted to try to lure potential investors into giving them money. And then there's the operating plan. And I tell people, you know, do an operating plan, but with an operating plan, you don't really have to worry about grammar and punctuation. You can just basically do it all in bullet point form. You know, you have a page on how you're going to do marketing and bullet points. You have another page on operations, how the product's developed, and so on. And this is just for you to look at. It's a reminder, another key, you know, management staff, you know, if you've got any partners, they're the only ones that really have access to this thing. Whereas the external business plan that I first mentioned, that has to be grammatically perfect. It's got 40 or 50 pages usually in terms of length. And a lot of people can take 2 or 3 months to write that thing up. And during those 2-3 months, nothing's happening. And you know, I just want to make this really important point here. My philosophy has always been, okay, it's going to take you a few months to start up a business in most cases. And it's also going to take you months to raise money. So my philosophy is, why not take that time period that you have available and use the bulk of it, say 80% of it, to try to generate some sales as quickly as possible instead of making the mistake that I see a lot of people making, which is to devote, you know, 2 or 3 months to writing up a business plan, then they devote another 2 or 3 months to shopping the business plan around potential investors, and at the end of 6 months, nothing's really happened. You know, they've made a business plan, they've bit the thing dozens of times based on feedback from potential investors, but other than that, nothing's happened. They've got nothing to show for all that effort and all that time, whereas the person who says, well, I'm just going to draft together a quickie operating plan in bullet point form. We're going to take 2 days to do that instead of, you know, 2 months, and then we're going to get cracking and go out there and start selling things. They're the ones that...
Right, and I think it's really important to understand, if you looked at the business you'd like to run, It is possible not to start that business, but to start a business that will build one by one the different parts of the infrastructure you need to do the next business. And so, it's like your friend with the tools.
There's a fancy term for that. It's called a transitional business model. And sometimes you can't step right into your ideal business. You're going to have to do some work before you can get there to build up the cash flow that will then allow you to acquire the assets that you need to run that, you know, dream business that you have. But I mean, that's just part of being an adult, being a grown up, and understanding, okay, you know, the things you need in life don't just fall out of the sky. Sometimes you got to, you know, go on the layaway plan, basically, and, you know, save up to get that dream business by doing something that's, you know, not exactly dream business, but it's going to produce some cash for you.
Now, I want to talk about two issues that come up early on, particularly if you do end up needing some capital. And one is the valuation issue, which is, it's very easy early on to disagree about what this thing is, what this puppy's worth. And I know you have another book on royalty financing, which is a very interesting kind of workaround of the valuation question. So maybe if you could talk a little bit about valuation early on in the startup and then the idea of using royalty financing to deal with it.
Sure. Well, I was involved with a lot of valuations because I was a business broker helping people to buy and sell businesses for about 10 years. So valuations are always a problem, even when you're talking about an established business, you know, with a history of 5 or 10 years going back where you can look at the actual financial statements or the tax returns. It's a challenge there. But if you're talking about placing a valuation on through a startup where there's nothing to look at, you know, it hasn't sold anything, it hasn't even left the starting block, so to speak, that's where, you know, you're guaranteed to have problems. And typically what happens is the rookie entrepreneur expects some significant amount of money in exchange for, you know, 10% of the company. And on the other side of the table, you've got the investors who, even if they really like the idea, typically will expect to be given, voting control of the company, 51% or whatever, so that they can lay off the founder in case he's not doing a good job. And, you know, they're just interested in protecting their investment. So you quickly come to these serious chasms between the two sides. They usually are deal killers. They're very frequently deal killers. And that's why I don't really like to get involved with startups anymore. I mean, I get calls all the time from people doing startups and they want me to act as an advisor for them and so on. And I just try to avoid those situations because they're really frustrating. So the valuation is a real deal killer. Now, the revenue-based financing that you mentioned a moment ago, it eliminates the valuation problem. And let me just explain what revenue-based financing is very quickly. I first discovered this back in the 80s. Basically, suppose you need $100,000 to get a company up and running. Well, you know, we'll use nice round numbers. What you can do is, once you've identified some investors, is tell them this: look, I need you guys to give me $100,000, and what I will do is I will give you a royalty payment calculated on my top line, that is, you know, the revenue line on the income or the profit and loss statement. And so, if in 1 month I make $10,000 in revenues, you guys will get whatever the agreed upon royalty payment is. Say it's 10%. Well, you know, if I pulled in $10,000, I give you guys $1,000. You guys get paid first as the investors. And I'm going to keep making those revenue royalty payments until I have paid you back an agreed upon sum. And that agreed upon sum is usually a multiple of the principal. So if the company received $100,000, it might agree to pay back $200,000, $300,000, $400,000. So obviously, you know, it's kind of an open-ended thing. Nobody really has any idea how long it's going to take the company to pay back, you know, three or four times the original principal. It's all based on how well it's doing from month to month in terms of selling. And just to make it clear for people listening in, a revenue-based financing is different from a loan because a loan stipulates a uniform monthly payment, and that monthly payment has to be made whether the company's doing well and can afford to make the payment or if it's not doing well. You know, you've got to make that payment. It's like a mortgage payment, whereas revenue-based financing is a little bit more flexible. It says, well, you know, we just want 10% or 5% or 1% off up each month, whatever that sum is, and those revenues might go up and down from month to month. So it's flexible, and if you know, and typically if in a particular month you didn't have any revenues, then there wouldn't be a revenue royalty payment made that month.
Right.
So you know, just to answer your question about valuation, because the investors know that they're being the party that's the first to be paid out each month from the top line, they don't really care about the valuation. It's no longer an issue. It's not even discussed. It just becomes completely irrelevant. You know, they just know that they're going to be receiving a certain amount of cash flow each month, which is a percentage of the revenues, and that's all they really care about. And I should just add very quickly that another big drop is the fact that you don't have to worry about exits. That's the other big deal killer
right. In
financing small companies. Investors want to know when they'll get their money out, and usually they get the typical ways to get their money out is for the startup to be acquired by a bigger corporation, or if it's really big, to do an IPO. And the reason why a lot of investors will tell you after they've talked to you that, you know, they're really not interested is because they just don't see an exit. They don't see how they'll recover their money. So with revenue royalties, you eliminate those two huge deal killers. You eliminate the valuation problem. It just becomes totally irrelevant. And the exit problem is solved because they know that you know, over the course of the next 2 or 3 years, they will recover an amount which is equal to, you know, 3-4 times their original principal.
Both the book on revenue, what's the name of the revenue financing book?
Well, I call it How Deal Makers Close Investors, and it's specifically about how to use what are called revenue royalty certificates to utilize this type of finance.
Right, it has quite a lot of information on the documentation and sort of the details. So it's very, you know, it's very useful from a practical standpoint. But one of the things I love in both that and the Startup Guide, you really help an entrepreneur understand the investor's point of view, and you know, they're really not looking at this as a company. They're sort of looking at, I put money into the machine and then I get money back. And it's a very different
exactly.
point of view. And, you know, whether it's an angel investor or venture capitalist, you really break it down and, you know, kind of look at it from their standpoint. So it's you know, it's very good. Another issue I wanted to talk about, in addition to valuation issue, is one that's near and dear to my heart, which is the control issue. And I put up the link to the... in the last couple of years, I've helped two friends capitalize businesses. One was a media company, and we helped them design an A share, B share model where the founders and sort of a family control the voting shares, which is the A shares, and then everyone, including the family, make their money on the B shares. And we did a big study. My attorney, Carolyn Betts, did a huge study of media companies, and we put that link up. And it's very useful because you see the different sort of A-share, B-share models used by media companies to sort of protect editorial privilege. And then I did Carolyn and I did a capitalization for a wonderful company, just startup in Tennessee, and did an A-share, B-share model where the founders, which is essentially a family, controlled the voting shares and then turned around and gave themselves B shares and sold B shares. And it's we stripped out the names, and it's a link up in the links to help you understand what that model looks like and how it works, and to duplicate it if you want. I don't know. I come from a firm on Wall Street, Peter, that used the A share B share model early on in sort of the old timey leverage buyouts in the 20s and 30s. They sort of put their name on the A share, B share model. So I don't know if you've ever used that at all.
I've had involvement with companies that use that many times in the past. I've had a lot of experience with public companies and so on. So yes, that's a very good way of maintaining control of the company. It's a little bit more sophisticated than the revenue-based financing that I talked about, which is pretty simple.
Oh, sure. If you could do the revenue finance and not worry about setting up an equity structure and keep all control of the equity, mm-hmm. you know, that's definitely one way to go if you can do it.
Mm-hmm.
For something that is probably going to grow bigger and longer and faster, you know, in this situation, the family had reason to want to kind of split out the equity among each other.
Mm-hmm.
So part of it was, you know, that. So there was a reason to set up a corporate equity capital structure.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway.
Well, lots of exciting things happening in terms of financing. The revenue financing models is really taking off. There's a whole bunch of websites, but most of them just do that type of financing for established companies that have, say, a track record of 3 or 4 years. But, you know, if you're a startup and you're looking at using this type of financing, it's still doable. You know, you just need to find some individuals who believe in you and who would be willing to invest on, in, you know, using that type of instrument.
Can you explain for us what an angel investor is and how you go about finding angels?
Sure. Okay. The way I like to explain the whole financing thing for companies that'll go all the way, and by all the way I mean, you know, to do an IPO, is think of a four-person relay team where they pass the baton. And in this case, the baton is the startup. So the first member of the baton team is the angel investor. Those are usually just private individuals who have small amounts of capital to invest. You know, by small, it could be $10,000, it could be $50,000, it might be $100,000. And usually they invest as part of a group. So you might have like six joined together. They all believe in the company and they invest in it. They all put in the same amount of money into it. Then they're always looking for at their exit, and the exit is the number two runner on the relay team, and that's the venture capitalist who provides more capital. These are professional firms that have raised usually these days in the billions of dollars, and they have a portfolio of companies that they invest in. Then the third player in the baton, you know, that the baton is passed to, is the investment bank that starts prepping the company to do an IPO, and then, you know, they'll inject some capital in there usually as well, bridge financing and so on. This gets kind of complicated, and then the fourth player that picks up the baton and provides financing is the public, you know, once the company is actually listed on a stock exchange. So that's kind of a way of looking at it that's helpful in understanding the whole financing process. And an important point there is, you know, everybody's looking down the road as to how they're going to exit and pass the baton off to somebody else and get recover their money. So, and as far as angel investors go, it's a matter of talking to people. They're all over the place. I mean, no matter where you live, they're all over the place. You know, there might be, say, retired local business people. There's a lot of people who, you know, spent their lives running a business. They really enjoy the process, but now they're retired and maybe they have some money that they might be willing to invest in a local company just to help the local community and so on. So it's a matter of networking locally, going to the Chamber of Commerce meetings and so on in other organizations, talking to people. You can also go to my website there, and if you click on the menu bar along the top for angel investors, it'll lead you to a national directory of angel investor clubs and chapters across the United States and Canada. And you might have one that's not that far off from you, you know, possibly within a car commute, and you can contact them. But they're usually interested more in the stuff that has the potential to really hit it big. You know, technology company, software company, an internet company, and so on. You know, they want something that's going to, you know, be passed along by all four members of that relay team and end up, you know, hopefully publicly trading on the NASDAQ or somewhere. But there are a lot of other angel investors who just want to help build up a local company. Maybe there's a crying need in a community for a certain type of business, which just doesn't exist, and everybody knows that the community needs this type of business. And if you can connect with these people, you might be able to put the capital together to start building this type of business.
Yeah, I generally find, you know, I find most angels to be people who just like building, and they like helping other people build.
Exactly. And, you know, that's very
true. They're wonderful people to hang around with. So.
Yes. And you can learn a lot from them.
Yeah, you can learn an awful lot from them.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, they like.
I don't know how we're.
They don't want to put.
Sorry.
Go ahead.
I don't know how we're doing on time, but you know, you and I had a brief chat the other day about crowdfunding, which is just.
Yes, I wanted to go into that next.
Okay,
so tell
great.
Us about crowdfunding, because I find crowdfunding to be, you know, one of the things that has really impaired the circulation of equity to startups is all the government laws and regulations, and I find crowdfunding to be a very clever leapfrogging around a lot of the, you know, a lot of the sort of obstacles that are thrown up by the legal system. So why don't you go into it? What
okay.
is crowdfunding, Peter?
Well, basically, it's you put up a page on an existing website, and there's a whole bunch of these websites that do crowdfunding. I'll name a few in a moment. But basically, it's a place where small investors and small companies come together and meet one another. So these types of sites will attract people who have as little as $20 to invest, or $50, or $100. They're usually typically small sums, but the site might have thousands of these people as members. Then you have small companies that come along. They open up an account at one of these websites, or they open up an account at two or three of these websites, and they basically pitch their deal. And I've seen some of these pitches. You know, they'll do a video, sort of a YouTube-style video demonstrating the product. They'll introduce the founding team members. So there's a little bit of, you know, pizzazz added to these things. It's not like, here, read our executive summary. And if people like a particular concept, you know, they like the product, they like the founder, and so on, they can say, well, okay, I'm committing to, you know, $25 to this company. And the way it usually works is the money is held in reserve until all the capital required is raised. If for example, if a company, say, looking for $50,000, and it only raises $45,000, well, that money is not released. It's basically refunded back to the people who provided the capital. It's a way of protecting the investors, because if the company claimed that it really needs $50,000 to do something, to service a certain milestone, and it doesn't raise all that money, then you know, there's a risk involved there. It's like, why give somebody, you know, just a part of the money that they really need?
I've participated in a couple of crowdfunding syndicates. I just put in $100 on another one. And the thing I like that I find very interesting about crowdfunding is it will fund not just a company but a project. So you can do, so Kickstarter does artists, so you can do a movie. Or apparently some guy up at Boston University wanted to make a documentary on the banjo, the history of the banjo, and he was short from his grant of $40,000, and he raised it on Kickstarter to his shock and amazement.
right. Yeah, no, it's an absolutely wonderful way of funding small companies or funding projects that you believe in. And there's different categories of crowdfunding sites. You know, there's debt-based ones where you get the money in the form of a loan, and then you have to repay that loan. And then there's equity-based ones where people invest in the money, realizing that, you know, they might lose their investment. And there's also donation-based ones where people just say, hey, this is a great thing. I don't expect anything in return from you. Here's my $25 or my $50 or however much they want to give. And I find it really exciting. When I was about 10 years old, I found out about this man called James Ling from Texas. And James Ling used crowdfunding to create his first business, which was an electrical contracting business back around 1955. And what he did was he sold shares in his company at various fairs in Texas. You know, he'd set up a little booth at the state fair and, you know, pitch his company, and he raised a couple of $100,000. And then by about 1965, just 10 years later, he had the 14th largest company in the United States. He was sort of a financial wizard, and he was very good at doing acquisitions of companies. So that's how he grew. And his nickname is James Ling, the Merger King. You can look him up on the internet. There's a great story about him on the New York Times website from back around 2002 when he died. But he just set my imagination on fire. And that's why I like crowdfunding. And we're going to see big things happening this way. And part of the reason I like crowdfunding so much is that basically elbows Wall Street and the venture capitalists.
It elbows Wall Street right out of the middle.
Yeah. It's, you know, to use that word that I haven't really heard all that much since late 1990s, you know, it's a disintermediation. You're getting rid of these people that really don't contribute all that much to the process, and you're just being the actual users and, you know, suppliers of capital directly together. One of the things that I've been meaning to do is just, you know, sign up at a couple of these sites, like with the Kickstarter Rocket Hub is another popular one. I just, you know, put $100 or a few, you know, $200 into an account and just play around with supporting companies.
Yeah.
And just get a
kick. It's fun. It's really fun to do.
Before
we close, I just wanted to mention, and let's go to the movies, I'd encourage people to watch Startup.com, which is a 2001 documentary film that describes a dot-com startup by a former Goldman Sachs employee. And it's really an example of the big venture model that you kind of, you know, the smart model is a way of getting out of that model, but it really shows a group of entrepreneurs who get on the big capital treadmill.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course,
you know, I've got a copy of that. I bought a copy from Amazon years ago, and I absolutely love that documentary. And
it's fascinating.
It's fascinating. And the thing to be aware of is you've got two partners. One loves schmoozing, doing presentations to investors. You know, he's just in his element. The other guy just wants to be back at the office doing coding and building the website. So there's this friction there between the two of them. And I've always been more like the second guy. I think his name was Tom, who just wanted to be back, you know, building
the product. Tom Herman really wanted the products to happen and for the things to work.
Mm-hmm. So that's a great one. That's a good one to watch.
Well, Peter, this has been fantastic. If you could, can you describe how we can access the materials? The link is up in the resource section on the blog, so we can link you to the special Solaria link at your website and get the materials. But if you could just walk them through your website and how we can stay current on your work.
Sure. If you go to antiventurecapital.com/Solari, sometimes you have to add .html after the Solari and sometimes you don't. I guess I don't know why you sometimes have to use it, why sometimes you don't. But it's there, antiventurecapital.com/Solari.html. There's a special offer there for anybody who's interested in the products. You can save about $60 on them. And I write a blog that's on the website itself. I sort of have a reputation for not taking a lot of things too seriously, or the players and so on. So you'll find a lot of humor in there. Hopefully you like my brand of humor. Some people don't, but it's just a way of keeping up with interesting ways of financing various projects and so on. And I try to put up a post or two every week that would be of interest to anybody who's looking at getting into business and becoming their own boss and building something up.
Well, it's funny, I've started many businesses and I've grappled with these issues many times, and every time I read it, I learn something new. So, Peter, it's the best package of materials on how to finance a startup that I know of. So I can't thank you enough for that, and for joining us on the Solera Report. And when you do dive into the archives, I really want to hear some feedback. Okay.
I will definitely do that. There's that ancient Chinese curse, may you live in interesting times. Well, we certainly live in interesting times. It wasn't supposed to be this way, when I entered my 50s and so on. I'm in my mid-50s now. It's supposed to be all smooth sailing, but there's no way of telling where the world's going right now. So I will definitely be going through your archives, because that type of information is extremely relevant.
Thank you. Thank you so much again. You have a wonderful evening. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, that's it for this evening. Next week, Adam Trombley back to do Zero Point Energy. Please get your questions, and I'm going to make sure I get them all to Adam ahead of time. Adam is featured in the Thrive trailer. So, again, go to thrivemovement.com or do a search in the blog. You'll pull it up. It was up last week, this weekend. And it's short. It's just about 3 minutes, and you'll get a great shot of Adam talking about Zero Point Energy there. So that's going to be very interesting. And then October 6th, we have the third quarter wrap-up. The wrap-ups are very important, a time to really sit back and look at what's going on. And given what's happening in the financial system, there's going to be a lot to talk about. And then, of course, on the 13th of October, I'll be back in Tennessee with Franklin Sanders for the Precious Metals Market Report. So until next week with Adam Trombley on Zero Point Energy, please remember, don't worry about whether or not there is a conspiracy. If you're not in a conspiracy, then you need to start one. Ladies and gentlemen, good night and good luck.